We're live.
Good evening, everyone. I would like to call the study session of the University City City Council meeting to order a little after 5:30. First and foremost, are there any changes to the agenda this evening? Mr. Rose.
Honorable Mayor and council members, I would ask to pull agenda item J2 off of the consent agenda and move that to the city manager's report as item K6.
Okay. Anything else? Hearing none. Mr. Rose.
Honorable Mayor and council members, tonight we would like to present to you information on the National Floodplain Insurance Program. If you recall, we are a participant in that program, and we must participate as a city in order for our residents to be eligible for flood insurance. There are some changes that we intend to make as far as being a participant that Darren Dunkel, who is the interim director over Public Works, will be sharing with you tonight. Mr. Dunkel.
Thank you, Mr. Rose, Mayor Crowe, members of council. As Mr. Rose stated, that the National Floodplain Insurance Program is a voluntary program that municipalities and counties can be a part of or not be a part of. Basically, it's an agreement between the federal government, FEMA, and the local communities. And basically, they want to provide federally backed flood insurance coverage, not just to the people that are in what most people refer to as the 1% floodplain, but it's available to any resident to purchase this insurance. And basically, they want to mitigate the chances of flood, damages done to flood, the risk associated with that. And one of the criteria of that is that any bank or mortgage company that provides a mortgage to someone who lives basically what's called the AE zone flood insurance, they have to carry flood insurance coverage if they have a mortgage. If they own the home outright, it's up to the owner if they want to carry flood insurance or not. As part of the city's participation, we had to pass a floodplain management ordinance that at a minimum meets the FEMA requirements, or it can exceed the requirements. Sorry. As part of that, you know, this is available, you know, to homeowners, residents, renters, business owners, you know, who live in the community, they have that. And for example, you know, a single family residential building, they can be insured up to $250,000 in coverage, and that is for the structure with contents up to $100,000. If you're a renter, you can get insurance up to $100,000 just for the contents of your home. Now, if you're a business, or as us as a city is thrown into that business category, we can have up to $500,000 coverage on our buildings, as well as $500,000 coverage on the contents of the building. And like I said, as part of this, there's regulations put in place, you know, for flood disasters and issues that go with that. And what we are trying to do is make sure that all of our residents and even our city facilities come into compliance with what our current ordinance states. And again, that is a minimum coverage that we're doing. Now, the benefits of this, like I stated before, that every homeowner business is eligible. If we were not part of this program as a city, no one would be able to get flood insurance within University City. And again, as I said, if it's any federally backed mortgage companies, banks, it requires them to have flood insurance. One of the other benefits of this, once a presidential declaration has been made after a disaster, the city is then eligible for public assistance, for grants are available internally for us to fix roads, bridges, and other debris removal. Also, it opens up the opportunities for residents to apply for additional FEMA funds. It also provides mitigation opportunities for grants, such as for buyouts, buy-in warning sirens, and other items that might be needed. If you look at University City, and again, I will stress some of these numbers were prior to this flood and does not include all the numbers since the flood, since all those numbers are not in yet. But basically currently there's 259 policies within University City that individual homeowners or the city has. That's close to $50 million in coverage through the floodplain insurance. Prior up to this flood, basically 1,100 claims have been made since 1978, and that's when the city joined the program. And about close to $16 million has been paid out thus far. Now, one of the things that we are working through right now, as part of the city being a member of the floodplain insurance, that you have to have a floodplain administrator. By our ordinance, it is the director of public works. And as part of that, what the city has to do is after a disaster, you have to go out and do substantial damage estimates. And these aren't to all homes. These are only to homes and businesses that are located in what they call the special flood hazard areas, or it's that 1% flood, 1%, or the what some people refer to as the old terminology, 100-year floodplain. And so when I say that we have to go out and do these inspections, these are not full-blown inspections of someone's home. These are basically quick, rapid inspections that we try to, if we can't get into the structure, it's from the exterior, that you try to look to see where flood marks are on the exterior of the home. You could see if a air conditioning compressor was underwater, you know, those sorts of things. And there is a whole form that staff must fill out. And as you go through that, there's a whole formula that goes through that looks at the appraised value of the structure, not of the property, but of the structure. You look at the percentage of the estimated damage, and then you look at what has been deemed a standard construction price for replacement, and all that is computed out. And one of the things that we do on that is that we will be sending letters out. We are a little behind on this due to just going through this, and we had help from SEMA to go through this, but we will be sending out to those homeowners telling them what our estimates are on that. And again, these are only estimated damages on that. For example, if we put in that someone's home was 39% damaged and it computed out to a cost of $50,000 and the home is worth $100,000, then that means that they had 50% or more damage, which throws them into a category that they're going to have to do more work to their home to get it out of that floodplain and do floodproofing, those sort of things. If you fall below the 50%, then you're not required to do those things right away. And they look at some things over a 10-year period. But again, like I said, these are rapid visual inspections. They're not full-blown inspections by staff. I will tell you, this year we had the help of the code enforcement team that went out and made these inspections. And like I stated here, that we will send out a letter to all the property owners to let them know what the assessments were, about the 50 percentile, those sort of things. Now, one of the deceiving things that's going to be, and we're already currently experiencing this, it might say in the letter that we said a home was only 39% damaged. It came out to an estimate based off of the formula that it was only going to cost X amount of dollars, and it might be below that 50% threshold. But when they turn in their permit application from their contractor, it might say that it's a much higher number, what they want to get done, and that might throw them over that 50% mark. So they are going to have to do additional work to get it to get into compliance with our ordinance. So those are the things that we're working on right now. Some of this maybe require homeowners to elevate their structure. Basically what they do, you look at what the base flood elevation is off the FEMA firm maps. And basically if it comes in that your level is at 520 and you go look at your home and your home is at 518, that means you're 2 feet below what the base flood elevation is. Our ordinance says you have to be a foot above the flood elevation. So in a sense, you're basically 3 feet out of compliance. So there's going to be some alterations that may take place if you're at that 50% or more substantial damage. Now, I know there's a lot of stuff there to digest, and that's why it takes staff time to go do our due diligence to look at all of these things. Once we issue the permit, then we have to go back and inspect and do repeat inspections on it to make sure that they are in full compliance. If they continue to do work without having the floodplain development permit, or we find they will be in violation, and this could also throw the city in violation. And one thing a lot of people don't understand, this isn't just because of the recent flood. This is something that should take place year round. Even if you come into the planning department and say you want to pull a permit for a water heater or to replace your HVAC, you still have to fill out a floodplain development permit. And we have to keep track of that, because we have to keep track over a 10-year period if that amount puts you over the 50% value of your structure, which could throw you into a new category. So those are one of the things that we have to do. We talk about the substantial improvement. We've already talked about that a little bit, about the 50%. And basically what they say, any development in the floodplain, and a lot of people, when you think of development, they think of a developer coming in and doing something. The way the FEMA rules read, development means any man-made change in what you're doing to your current property or to your structure. And so that throws it all in there. And like I talked about, we looked at substantial damage. We look at substantial improvement. We also have to look at repetitive loss. If there's a certain home or an area that every flood that we have continues to get flooded out, we have to keep track of all that as well. Like I said, permitting, again, it has the definition here of any man-made change, improved or unimproved real estate, such as building structures, levees, levee systems, mining, dredging. This could even be by putting in a new driveway at your residence. You would have to get a floodplain permit because you're doing excavation and it could change or alter your property. Also, you look at new development. New development could be an infill development in a neighborhood, or it could be for a commercial property of development. They have to come into compliance with all that as well, and with our city ordinance. Talked about violations. Again, the violation, there are several types of violations. One is on the city. If the city is found to be in violation, or found that we have deficiencies in our administration or enforcement of these things, that the city could be placed onto probation. If the city happens to be placed on probation, there would be a surcharge added to everybody's insurance who has floodplain insurance, and that could be up to 20% increase until the city came back into compliance. If the city did not come back into compliance, then they could basically suspend us from the program, which means that the people who have flood insurance could remain in it for that term, but they could not renew their insurance, nor could anyone else get purchase insurance for that. So it is very critical for us, you know, from a staffing standpoint, that we go through these procedures. And it is very time consuming, and I understand, because I've been talking to a lot of the residents. We've been processing and going through a lot of these permits, and it gets tricky on trying to go through this mathematical formula and to look at the type of improvements they're doing to determine what their next step is. And this could be very costly for some residents and not as much for others, just depending on the level of improvements that they want to do. And also a part of this, which is tricky, that once you go past a certain point on the 50% basements, if you're in the AE flood zone, you cannot have a livable basement. You cannot have any rooms, restrooms, or anything in your basement. And there are some people that have been here forever that may have finished basements and that stuff, but they would no longer be able to have that once they meet that 50% threshold. And so there's a lot of caveats to this, and each one of them has to be viewed on an individual basis, because it's not a one size fits all, other than the formula that we have to use to make those determinations. Anybody have any questions?
Questions from members of council? Mr. Hales.
Thank you. Since you just were on this topic, on the finished basements, does that mean they would have to be removed or torn out, or does it mean they just wouldn't have any coverage under the program?
No. If they meet that 50% percentile over, They could technically, they cannot have any livable space. We could not approve any permits or anything for that. And what they would have to do, most likely, they would have to floodproof those basements so that if water came up, that they're one of the examples they have, you have to have windows that are kind of like self-release, that the floodwaters would push those windows in and flow through the basement. There's a lot of different things, and it gets into a lot of different categories of what you can do to floodproof. And some of those, we are still doing some research on, you know, because we've had people, do I have to raise my home? Well, it depends on the category, that, because that gets very costly to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Mayor Crow, and Director Dunkel, thank you for your presentation. We know that flood insurance is also available on the private market. How do the rates for this program compare, if you can offer that, to the private market?
Well, this goes through the private market.
Okay.
This program is set up, the insurance companies are part of it and backed by the FEMA through that way. So that's how it works. But like I stated, if you have a mortgage on your property, you are required to have this insurance if you're in that AE zone. But there's some people that we have heard, some residents have paid off their home and they thought there was a less probability of getting flooded. So they decided not to buy the flood insurance, and now they were flooded.
So just to be clear for those, for myself, frankly, and those who may be listening, so you don't have to necessarily be in those flood areas in order to participate in this program.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause this is covered citywide, that everyone is eligible.
Okay. Cause we know with the recent flooding, there were many homes, many, many homes that got flooded that never had a drop of water anywhere near them.
Correct.
So it is eligible. So it goes through the private market. So it's not a government program in the sense that you are purchasing insurance from the government.
Right.
But it's through private insurance carriers.
Correct.
Okay. And one thing you said, I just wanted to clarify for those listening. You said if the city did not participate in this program, residents could not get flood insurance. Just to be clear, they couldn't get flood insurance through this program. They could get it just on the private market themselves, correct?
Well, my understanding of it is that the only way that you can get the floodplain insurance program through this program is that you have to get it. You know, the city has to be a partner part of this. Now, to be honest with you, I'm not an insurance person, so I don't have all the answers. But my understanding is that you have to go through an insurance agent that's part of this program.
But either way, we are. So if you need flood insurance and you live in U City, you can go get it.
Right.
Okay.
You are correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Cusick.
Thank you, Mayor Crow. Mr. Dunkel, I have several questions, some of which are just for clarification purposes. When you said that if a house's value is more than 50%, the loss on a house is more than 50%, what is the valuation of the property? Is it based on the St. Louis County Tax Assessor's Office assessment?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And it's on the structure only. It is not based off of the property. It is based off of the structure.
Okay. And then in this report, it states that there are 259 flood insurance policies. And you said that that was residential and city owned. The notes say that the city could have flood insurance of up to $500,000. Is that per building or per city?
That is per policy. Now, I'll try to clarify that, because like with the city, we could have maybe multiple buildings part of one policy, or they could be separated on an individual policy.
So would you have a rough idea of the 259 flood insurance policies in University City? Do you know how many of those are on University City owned buildings and how many are private?
I think on city owned buildings, we have like five or six off the top of my head that are city owned facilities. And then the rest of them would be residential or could be commercial, because there are a few commercial buildings within that number.
And then I taking into consideration what you said, that a lot of this information may be somewhat outdated because of the recent flooding, but you said that since 1978, there were 1,140 claims that have been made. Do you know as of what date that happened?
I do not have the dates. This was information that SEMA shared with me, and I can try to get more information, updated information to you if you would like.
On that point, it's okay. I don't need that. And then let's say that I want to talk about the elevation and the compliance. If someone is over, if the valuation of their house is over 50% with the recent flooding, and I'm thinking specifically of several streets, Vernon, Dartmouth, of course, Wilson Avenue, and other streets where a buyout is not going to be feasible, but those houses probably exceeded 50% losses on their valuation. So are we going to require that those houses be elevated?
We will have to look at them on an individual basis to see what they're right now. I can tell you, I think there were only 5 or 6 properties that were evaluated at 50% or more. There was a lot that were close. And again, these evaluations were just based off estimates. Now, the other part of it is, if a homeowner comes in, and we've had this, we're dealing with this right now, homeowner came in and say the value of the structure is $166,000, but the cost that they brought in for their permit for construction to reconstruct, it's $135,000. That's way more than 50%. So we are currently going through that. And actually, as of today, I've reached out to FEMA and SEMA to give me some of this stuff is fuzzy, that we are asking, what is it that they have to do? Are there other options? Because I'm hearing from some homeowners, if my home's only worth $166,000 and you're telling me I have to elevate my home, which I've heard some numbers that are close to $90,000 to $100,000, it's not worth their while to do it. They just feasibly can't do that. I'm asking for FEMA and SEMA if they can get me information. Are there alternate methods that we can do to flood-proof a residential home other than raising it out of that floodplain? Hopefully I should have the answer in the next day or two on that.
Okay, I would like to know what you find out about that. And I would like to add that in the it was several years ago that we did look at the elevating several houses in the floodplain area, and we were told that they could not be elevated enough. So if someone has a home that's in the floodplain and it's been flooded and the elevation would have to be at least 10 or 12 or 15 feet to make a difference, what are we going to do? What are we going to tell those homeowners that they have to? And if there's not a buyout, then how is that going to be feasible for the homeowner?
Right. And these are the answers that I'm waiting for right now. Hopefully I should have in the next day or two on those items, because I think it will affect a few of our residents.
And then I wanted to ask about the, do you know what the average, you had some numbers in here about what the cost of the flood insurance program is. Do you know what that breaks down to per household? Let's say on a home that's valued at $150,000, do you know what that would be for their annual flood insurance?
No, I do not. I do not know the flood insurance rates.
Okay. And then what if a resident, I want to go back to the mitigation and the floodplain development permit. Again, what if a resident just doesn't have the wherewithal, the financial wherewithal to do all of these mitigating things to their home that are defined by FEMA? I'm very concerned about this because we don't have an option for them. So is FEMA going to mandate that we have to that they do these things?
My understanding, yes, we have to do them or we'd be in violation of the agreement with the insurance policy, and we would go into that violation of being put on probation or suspension from the program. That these are the regulations that FEMA sets out, and it's for us as a city, we have to enforce those.
And I don't expect you to be able to answer this, and perhaps this is a rhetorical question, but what are we going to do when we find that we have residents that can't afford this and we would be in violation, or they would be in violation, and then it would, by default, University City would be in violation. So I think that that's something that needs to be considered when discussing this issue with FEMA.
Right.
Thank you.
Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Cusick, our intent is to work very closely with SEMA and FEMA to gain compliance. We certainly appreciate the economic situation that many of our residents are in, especially after having experienced this devastating historic flood. So our goal is not to move people out of their homes. It is, though, however, to be in compliance so that we can ensure that other residents within the city have the opportunity to have flood insurance. I cannot imagine a situation where SEMA or FEMA wouldn't be sensitive to that and be willing to work with us as well as the resident on timing for compliance and methods for compliance. But that's something that we'll need to work very closely with SEMA on.
Thank you. And if we could have some follow-up on that in the next couple of months, if possible. And then Mr. Rose, was there something that happened other than just the recent floods that that required us to go over this whole policy? Has FEMA done something recently to make us look at this again and bring this up other than the recent flood events?
Honorable Mayor, Councilmember Cusick, it was the recent flood events that brought greater attention to this issue. And that's a result of the magnitude of the losses that have been experienced here in University City. And so as a part of that process, we wanted to ensure that we were in compliance at this point and did not jeopardize our compliance in any way. So it was the historic flood that brought this, placed this issue on the radar. Our desire to make sure that that we remained in compliance with the National Flood Insurance Program.
Anything else on this item? Thank you, Mr. Dunkel.
Thank you.
Mr. Rose?
Honorable Mayor and Council Members, the second item is a presentation regarding the Heeman Park basketball courts refurbishment. This item was presented to the Parks Commission several weeks ago, and they recommended that the Mayor and Council receive this presentation. Mr. Dunkel, anything to add on that?
No, Mr. Rose, as you have stated, this was brought in front of the Parks Commission on two different occasions. On the first one, it was just a basic overview of the concept. The second time, it was more of this presentation here to give us a little more depth and detail to what they were proposing. And tonight, I have here Asia Garrison, who's going to be giving the presentation. So.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for meeting with me or allowing me to speak before you. I am a little nervous, but I'm going to be really quick. So I will be presenting tonight. The presentation does say Mawine Bates, but he is actually on a basketball tour right now, so he was not able to make it. So a couple of months ago, Mawine came up with an idea to refurbish the Heeman Park courts, highlighting three people that were from University City. So the name of his organization is Big Guards Give Foundation, which is an organization that focuses on bridging athletes and community members together. He is very basketball driven, but he also is very community driven, and he wants athletes to be that as well. He values academics as well as community outreach. So Big Guards Give Foundation would be the overseer of this project. Big Guards Give Foundation is the one that is bridging the private donors, who we will discuss towards the end of the presentation. So one of the consultants for this project is Hoop for All Foundation. They are located out of Washington, D.C. I actually live in Washington, D.C., and I'm here for the meeting. And just about in June, this particular organization refurbished courts at the Benjamin Banneker Court, which is right across the street from Howard University, which is a historically Black college university. And who they dedicated the court to was Bradley Beal. One of the stipulations for the court was, he said specifically, specifically, if I decide to go with you guys and do this court, I have to do one in St. Louis as well, specifically University City, because Bradley Beal is from University City. So Hoops for All is a very good organization. They have been very helpful with just giving us the blueprint on how to go about this, how to present it to the city, what our budget should look like, the things that we need to make a project like this reality. I actually went to the court reveal at the Benjamin Banneker over the summer, and it was extremely nice. I really enjoyed how involved the community was. They gave a lot of scholarships. Bradley Beal was there. It was a lot of students and children there. It was just very nice. And it made me think as I was there, I said, oh, we have to do this in UCity. Also, I went to University City High School. So I am an alumni class of 2013. Centennial Commons was actually my first job in 2012. And I worked there throughout my undergrad and graduate degree. So I am very connected to University City. So why we chose UCity is because UCity is a very diverse community. UCity is very family oriented. My parents went to UCity. I mean, most people always say, like, if someone says they're from St. Louis, they specify University City. Like, yes, I'm from St. Louis, but UCity specifically. And I think that that speaks to the community and how we come together as one. I think that we have beautiful parks. Lion Pride spreads throughout the community, and Heman Park basketball courts have been there for a while. And most basketball players that are from St. Louis has played basketball at University City. Mawan, who is not here, who's my partner, he lives in University City currently, but he did not go to University City High School. But he talks about even currently how he played at Heman Park constantly, how he had a membership, a non-resident one to be exact, non-resident membership at Centennial Commons, and he just valued the community. So we believe with a lot of the infrastructure that is going on in University City currently, that a new basketball court would add to the facelift that University City is currently under. And we also believe that because the three private donors are wanting to donate this to us, that is perfect for us. So our mission is to provide a safe environment. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Our mission is to provide a safe environment for youth and community members, as well as for us to be able to host basketball camps and community events, and also to give scholarships to community members. One of the things that they did do at the Benjamin Banneker was give scholarships out from the donations that they received the day of to students that were headed off to college. I said, we need to do that here in UCity. So that's one of our missions. So the timeline where we're at right now is we need the city approval. The funding is based upon our approval. The donors are waiting to hear that we got the yes, and then we work out a budget with them. The next part would be to hire the sports contractors. We already have narrowed it down to two specific contractors that we want to work with. I actually had a meeting at the Heman Park course today with the contractor doing the measurements, as well as Friday, just to kind of give us a bid and understanding of what necessarily needs to be done. And then from there, we're going to hire the artist, which we've already did. We have an architect that is on our team, and he's designed the courts, which I will show you guys here in a second. And then adding the infrastructure, and finally the court reopening event, which we would like to make a very nice day post maybe around June, where we do a ribbon cutting ceremony. And it's just a really nice event. So some of the project benefits that we believe is community relations, youth empowerment, and also public relations and branding. We believe that this will be a great look for University City, a great way to bring the community together, a great way for children to have, and even adults, a new clean park, one that is safe, one that is good on the knees for those that want to play basketball, but also the youth empowerment. We want to partner with different businesses and even local community members to give back to the youth on this day. We want it to be a memorable day. We don't want it to just be, hey, a new basketball court, but no, who was impacted by this? Who got to go to college for free? Who received the scholarship to go to COCA based off of this event? Who was able to get free art classes due to the artists that we are working with? Like, how did this enrich the community?
So our project budget right now is estimated around $207,000 to $250,000. That budget can go up or down. So the construction is looking to be around $60,000. The artists and equipment between $15,000 and $20,000. For us to get new backboards and rims, it would be $15,000. The opening day event, we have budgeted that for about $10,000. And then the contingency fees, which would potentially go back to the donors, is $10,000. And one thing, which is still to be determined just based upon our budget, is having a shelter over the court, like a kind of look at it as a pavilion that covers the entire court, because that's going to help us when it comes to maintaining it. We want to not have to maintain every year or two. And the way that we can do that is preserving the court with this shed. So that way, with rain and snow and different things of that nature, that the court will be protected. And then it also gives it a completely different look. And the equipment would be $7,500. And then the basketball hoops would be $15,000. So University City's involvement, the only thing that we are asking from you guys is advertisement. As far as like flyers and banners, we love how UCity promotes different events like music in the park and different things of that nature. So we would just want that same support for the court opening day, as well as maybe even some website recognition, letting people know that, hey, this new court will be open in June, come out to the day opening, and then hands on the day of the event. This is actually one of the layouts that we have for the court right now. We have not posted this or anything. This is still very confidential as we're working out things with our donors. To the left, we have the Jason Tatum court. Jason Tatum is from University City. He talks about it all the time. He actually says UCity USA, which a lot of UCity people say. So one court would be dedicated directly to him, and also to his mom. The name of the court would be the Brandy Cole court. That's the red one. Because she went to University City as well. The middle court would be the University City court. That's dedicated to University City. And also to Nelly, because Nelly went to UCity. So we would like to include him on that particular UCity part. And then finally, we have the Bradbill court. And that one would be dedicated to his mother, Vestibule, who retired from University City. She was there for quite some time. She was my gym teacher, as well as many others gym teacher. One thing that we would like to add additionally, potentially, is the Deuce court, which is Jason Tatum's son. So we noticed that there's some open gravel area right next to the basketball courts. And if possible, we would love to add this particular court. Mawan actually traveled to New York and Miami strictly to look at basketball courts. And we noticed this theme. It's called the Bank Shot Court. It's not a regular basketball court because it's game centered. It's for children, and it's to teach them shapes, colors, geometry, trigonometry, and things of that nature. It's not a, if you shoot the ball, you win. It's more of a team building court. And we would like to add that directly to the side of the Jason Tatum court. And right next to that, you guys can kind of see how it would look. Right next to it, where the gravel would be. And then finally, do we have your support? I know I kind of ran through that a little quick, but I'm here to answer all questions in regards to the refurbishment.
Are there questions from members of council? Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Mayor Crow. And thank you so much for your presentation. I remember you as, I think, some of my colleagues.
I remember Centennial, you as well.
Collins, and also I was on the school board when you graduated.
Yes.
So great to see you again, and glad you're working with such a worthwhile organization.
Thank you.
So just want to be clear again. Okay. What you're asking of the city is the advertisement, the partnership, but you handle the fundraising.
Yes, 100% privately funded. That
sounds great. Thank you so much. And again, great to see you. I'm glad you're working with such a worthwhile organization.
Thank you.
Mr. Smotherson.
Thank you, Mayor Crow. Again, thank you for the presentation. I'm class of 75, and appreciate this offer. It's absolutely looks great. Question that I have is, you know, on your project budget estimate, you actually have, because, you know, I was an avid basketball player, but you have backboard rims, 15,000, but you also have basketball hoops. So define the difference. Or are they actually the same? if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes. Let me see.
You have backboard and rims, which would actually still be basketball hoops, which include that. So I'm trying to understand what you are differentiating in that.
They're the same. They're the same.
Yeah. So we can eliminate one of these boxes.
Yes, you can.
Okay. That's the first thing.
Okay.
The second thing is, what would the backboard and rims look like? And it's not something that you necessarily have to have now.
Okay.
If you could send that back to us, and so that we could actually see what the basketball backboard and rim would look like.
Okay, absolutely.
And another question, being a basketball player, are they breakaway rims?
No, they're not.
Okay, that's important. And that might be something we would need to look into.
Okay, we're definitely open to taking suggestions on the rims. We haven't even picked out which ones we're going to use yet. We're still looking at different companies to go with. So even if you guys had a suggestion on, since you're being a former basketball player, on what to use, we would take that and go with it.
Okay, last thing is Deuce Court. If you understand that you're going to put this, you want to put this on the east side of the basketball court, of the main basketball court.
Yes.
So there is a bike path and walking path that's right next to the basketball court. So you're talking about that area that's on the east side of that basketball, of that walking path. Is that correct?
I'm talking about the area right now. It's just gravel completely. And it's
not the parking lot. I'm not talking about the parking lot.
So is that a parking lot right next to it where it's a bunch of gravel? It's nothing there. It's the soccer court, the soccer fields, gravel, and then the court. So yes, we're talking about that in between. Oh, that's a parking area. Okay. So that would be the area that we were just talking about.
That's the area. Okay. I just wanted to be clear about where you were talking about. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rose, was there action taken by the park commission or by staff as far as bringing this item to us?
There was no action that's been taken. If it is agreeable to the mayor and council, my intention, the next step would be to have Mr. Dunkel work with Mr. Mulligan and try to craft just a very basic agreement so that the expectations were clearly outlined and start to move the project forward, but also bring that contract back to the council for consideration.
Mr. McMahon.
As part of this, can we just check up on MSD before we, because I don't want tanks to then we get this done, which we're all excited about. I know I am. And then MSD comes in and says, we're going to put some tanks there. And so that you may not, I think that might have come up at the parks meeting, but I think we want to check on that before. I don't want to miss this opportunity by waiting on tanks.
Ramir, the intention would be, yes, we'll check with MSD, but if you recall, as a part of MSD's initial proposal is that they would replace whatever they destroyed. And so we would make sure we have an airtight agreement with them if they decide to move forward with the tanks. But yes, we will confirm that.
So this evening, there's no action other than the report.
That is correct, Mayor.
Okay. Any other questions for our guests this evening, for our UCity alum? Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much.
I'm going to leave soon. I don't want you guys to think I'm leaving on you, but I do have a flight today. So I do want to give that disclaimer.
Well, we're going to take a break too. So it's all good.
Oh, okay.
It is all good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there's nothing else to come before the body, we will take a break until 6:30.